I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that out loud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of I Do Not Have Trash Politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Seen, the podcast.
It's not every day that we get to sit down with someone whose work and presence has truly shifted the way that we think and talk about co-conspiring alongside Indigenous sovereignty movements and challenge our understandings of borders as violent constructs. And yet, Lala and I did just that. This episode, we sat down with Harsha Walia, a South Asian activist and writer based in Vancouver or Coast Salish territories. Harsha is a multi-movement organizer and has been involved in community-based, grassroots, migrant justice, feminist, anti-racist, Indigenous sovereignty, anti-capitalist, Palestinian liberation, and anti-imperialist movements, including No One Is Illegal and the Women's Memorial March Committee in the Downtown East Side. She's a trained lawyer, she's an organizer, and she's the author of Undoing Border Imperialism, as well as Border and Rule, a book which I have and love. In this episode, you'll hear Lala and I continue on our journey of transformative justice for self, but this time really talking about the kinds of changes that make you have to be visible, have to be seen on brand, take up space, right? And how imposter syndrome and the fear of being seen can drive us towards things like perfection, which is a trap. We're going to hear about how Harsha has stayed rooted in her work and rooted to something bigger throughout her incredible career and work and activism. And if you don't know, you will soon learn that Harsha is a true Gemini queen with so much wisdom to share, which Lala and I debrief and unpack together. Take a listen. Welcome, Harsha. Selfishly, personally, I have been following your work for, I want to say, since undergrad. So since like 2011, just watching all of the really rad, incredible, dedicated activism. And I've just really admired you and thought, in the spirit of our season about transformative justice for self and this topic of the fear of being seen and what it means to have like a platform and what it means to take up space and all of this stuff, that you would be a really incredible person to have on the show as a guest. So I just want to say thank you for saying yes. Like, I really appreciate it. We really appreciate it. And my first question for you is just, how is your heart? Like, how are you arriving? How are you doing?
Thank you so much. Thank you for that generous welcome. Thank you for the invitation to be in conversation on, you know, in such thoughtful, grounded, as I was saying earlier, podcast. And also, you know, thank you for the generous words about my work, which is, of course, always done in community. We don't do any of this alone. And such a big part of being able to do that work is being able to do it alongside brilliant comrades like yourselves. And all the work that you're doing in the world and all this work that we do together in the, you know, as a constellation, really. I'm on unceded Coast Salish territories, lands of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people. And my heart is always often trying to think alongside Indigenous sovereignty struggles and what it means to literally, you know, as we do, walk on this land in a good way. And my heart is good. It's so good to be in conversation with you two. So I feel good. I feel cold. I literally have two hoodies on right now. I feel like a little cream puff, but I'm doing good.
I'd love to just jump right in. So a lot of this conversation, we're talking about sort of the fear of being seen. And I'm wondering, when you were first starting in advocacy and organizing type of work, what did it take for you to step forward into those public facing roles? Was there hesitation there for you? Was there fear? Like how was that process for you?
I'd say when I started being involved in organizing was shortly after 9/11. So over 20 years ago now. And for me at the time, I was part of radical anti-imperialist organizing that was incredibly fringe. Like we were collectives of 3 to 4 people and in a climate where fear is always paramount. But, for folks who weren't born and raised in the post 9/11 climate, it's really hard to explain the significant shift that particular moment had on political, cultural, social landscape in terms of heightened fear and just the immense chill factor for organizers. Like, rallies were getting canceled constantly that had been planned for years as part of the anti-globalization movement. So I think it was, explaining that context is to say that it was hard for many reasons, including the very specific climate, on top of all the other fears and, frankly, imposter syndrome as a young teenager immigrant and, everything layered on top of that, race, gender, language access, et cetera. And so probably for a good 10 years, when I was speaking out, I didn't really feel like I was speaking out in public. Like I just felt like I was speaking to like me and my 3 friends. Like our events were tiny. No one showed up. No one paid, for me, the kind of public facingness of it all is much newer in the broader trajectory. And so if anything, a lot of times it was actually like trying to be heard, if you will. And I'm not joking when I'm talking about, like, we had rallies where 3 people showed up. I remember them very well. And so, you're just trying to like holler as loud as you can because literally no one's there. So for me, that was the context in which being public and being seen was framed, which is very different than, it's pre-social media, for example. So there is no way to be seen other than to be like on the street or, publicly organize something. There is no other platform.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. It's so interesting to hear how that originated. So then I'm wondering how that evolved, like when you did start to have more of an audience or more of a platform, there's more people showing up, there's more different types of outlets for you. Did you feel like that experience made it a little bit easier to be speaking then, or was it just as terrifying? Was the imposter syndrome still there?
Yeah, the imposter syndrome is still there, especially around certain things. Like I have, I've written books, but for me, that's not a skill that comes easy. I primarily identify with like organizing, a lot of background stuff. Like things that come easier to me is ghostwriting, writing like press releases for a lot of folks in town. Logistics, I have like a logistics brain. So that's the stuff that comes easier to me. The change, I would say for me in the past few years, tried to be on socials less because I feel, the visibility is not something for me. It's intense. It's one directional, that feeling of like folks knowing things about you and you don't know anything about them can be weird. It's not as relational. When it starts to get too big, if you will. But it was definitely a learning curve. Like particularly social media is a learning curve when you come from not having had access to it to figure out what to do with it when you it's not the context in which you were raised, whether politically or otherwise. Like it's just not part of your generation. And I did find it hard. And one thing that has definitely made it harder to have platforms, whether it's social media or having written books, is it actually has made it much harder for me to organize in relations in the ways in which I did previously. Because it creates, it creates all kinds of dynamics of power, intimidation, fear, hesitation, not wanting to take up too much space, being aware. So it just, it's not as flattened. It's never flat. There's always layers, but it's added an additional layer that has made it challenging, frankly.
For sure. I'm curious about, it sounds like the evolution of the way that you engage with the public has had to shift because of social media. And you said that you are, trying to do it a little bit less and less. And when you just spoke to the non-relational, sort of one directional, and all of these things that are so challenging in the age of social media and in the age of there's so much, I would say, like noise to cut through. And people's ideas of you or people's ideas of your work and how they're not even in alignment with who you are and what you're doing. I'm wondering if you've ever felt, you know, that pressure to have to cut through that noise and how you cut through that noise, how you, you know, kind of maintain that sense of like self-preservation and balance, because there's so many eyes on you and there's so much like room for people to be critical. And I'm sure that also impacts just like your sense of self. So yeah, like how do you, yeah, cut through that, wade through the noise, know which noise is like worth even addressing and what's like actually, nah, I'm not even going to invest my time and energy there.
Yeah. And frankly, what makes it hard is not knowing who you're in conversation with. You know, like that's one aspect of social media is like maybe someone has a very generative critique or concern or feedback, or maybe they're a troll. And obviously in extreme examples, you can parse them apart, but sometimes you really can't because you have no idea. I would say for me, absolutely. I mean, one of the main reasons I don't go on social media anymore is just not being able to discern who I'm in conversation with, who to be in conversation with. And also because, you know, as any of us, like the ways in which we're intimate and vulnerable with our people is very different than like if we're, you know, speaking to like the world at large. And for me, one thing that certainly shifted is being able to use social media, you know, like a live journal, right? Where you're just putting yourself out there and like your fears, your vulnerabilities, your thoughts, working through ideas in a way that makes it harder when it feels like everything has to be, at least for me, in the way that social media is now and present in my life, where it's, you know, just feels like it's more curated, which makes it less and less interesting for me to engage with myself in that way.
Do you feel like the need to present things perfectly, if you know what I mean? Because like you just said, I'm always trying to work through like, how do I show the process? How do I show like what I'm still like mulling on? Like, how do I do that for myself just so that I don't have to hold myself to such a high standard of like perfection? But I hear what you're saying around like, there's sometimes not room for that. And you have to be really discerning of like who you let into that space of like, I'm figuring it out. Or what do you think? Do you feel like those things, you know, the pressure of perfection and like the desire to want to, you know, show people your work. I'm thinking about math, right? Like when they're like long form and show your work or whatever, like, do you feel like those things are completely at odds or there's some space to reconcile those two? And what do you think you lose if they're, you know, it has to be the press release that's sort of like, it's been formatted, it's been really detailed, it's been really perfected versus like Harsha, who's, I say this to myself, I'm just a baby girl. Like I'm just a human being.
Absolutely. And I think for me, it is possible to reconcile in relationship, you know, like in spaces, whether, you know, online or physical or, you know, just that are bounded in some way. Where there is some trust, because it also feels very bizarre and disingenuous to be vulnerable and intimate with people who I don't, again, don't even know if you're a troll or a human being or a bot. Like I have no idea who you are. So absolutely. And I think it's like impossible not to, it would be impossible to live without reconciling them, right? Because we can't live as like, you know, in a performance our whole lives. It's not true to our humanity. It's not fair to other people. I mean, I'm a big believer personally in like owning and processing mistakes because it is an unfair setup for everyone around us if it's always perfected. It's, you know, unfair to folks who are, not everyone is, but for those who are seeking guidance or mentorship to think that there is some standard. Like it's not, I'm generally love telling stories about mistakes because I actually find them also really hilarious. But you know, in the conversations like this, right, where I like know who I'm talking to. So for me, I very much believe in reconciling it and in the honesty and integrity of what it means to own that, you know, that process and that long math that you were sharing, because I think we need that in movement. We need that as humans to know that we evolve and we learn and what our processes are. It's just hard to do it when it's unbounded and like really just out to the universe, you know? So that's for me how I reconcile it is like, is it spaces that are shared and have some shared basis of understanding versus social media, which is, it's just, it's unclear where it's going and who's receiving it and with what intent.
Yeah. So with all of that noise, all of those people around you, and whether it is, you know, the trolls or the people with generative critiques or the people that you're in relationship with and working alongside, I imagine there just is a lot of noise, a lot of being pulled in different directions, a lot of people maybe expecting certain things from you, wanting certain things from you. What keeps you knowing that you're rooted to what is meaningful or what feels right to you? Or I'm just curious about what that maybe that internal compass or that internal groundedness feels like for you.
I think for me, because I was organizing for a long time in very small pockets of like, frankly, irrelevance to the world, that has kept me grounded. Like, I feel like if I didn't have that, I would be unmoored very quickly. As someone who's written books, and I had a job last year that was like very, very public, and you know, it went all kinds of ways. And so I think in all those instances, what's kept me accountable is the communities that I was part of prior to having more of a public kind of profile, for lack of a better word, because those are the communities that I feel accountable to, you know. So specifically within migrant justice movements, communities within the downtown east side, indigenous land-based struggles. So very specific people, if you will, very specific elders, very specific people, communities, families, elders, children, who have known me before all of this, who have known me since I was a baby. I still feel like a baby, even though I have a baby. You know, who are also unafraid of just like calling you out on shit, right? Being like, what are you thinking? What are you saying? And who can see that like three-dimensional aspect, not the like one-dimensional aspect. And so for me, that is the internal compass, is, you know, having people who've known you for a length of time, who are accountable to the same kind of politics and movements, and for whom, frankly, like my books and public persona is white noise to them. You know, so like thinking about like elders in the downtown east side who are like, yeah, we didn't read your book, but I just like telling people I have it. Like, you know, and I love that. I love that that's not what mediates our relationship. It's, you know, how we're in struggle together and being in service to them. So that's for me so necessary. And I know for sure that without that, I would be completely unmoored and lost in this, like, you know, and just these waves of stuff that kind of comes at you in the kind of public world. And so most of my paid work, for example, has always been outside of organizing for that reason, so that I have communities of people that I'm accountable to in a different way and that I'm in service to in a different way. And it also keeps the work that I'm doing grounded in service and in community. Does that make any sense?
That makes sense.
I don't know if anything I'm saying makes sense, because it's just
so much sense. Yeah, I love that. I love that, you know, even the internal compass is relational. You know, I think we can be so individualist, and it feels really comforting, the idea that our internal compass or our intuition doesn't have to be something that happens in isolation and in individualism, that it's something that we can really find and strengthen in relationship and in community. That feels really comforting to me.
I want to ask a question. It doesn't fly in the face of what you just said, but it's related to, and I'm sure you're going to connect this back to your previous response, but, you know, I would love to know what keeps you in your power, like keeps you courageous. I think of, and I appreciate, Lala, your comment about like that our compass is often, we think about it as just like, it's just me and me alone, and it has nothing to do with other people. And I also know for myself that if I don't have a strong sense of self, it can be so hard to like even be able to challenge my friends when they don't know how to support me in the ways that I need to, them to support me, or they don't know what I'm going through because I'm struggling internally with myself. And so I'm just curious of like the source within you that keeps you going and that keeps you courageous and that like affirms your own humanity. What does that internal script look like? Has that changed over time, given the fact that your sort of public, you know, roles have shifted from, you know, the three people at the protest to like just so many people knowing who you are and what you do for better or for worse?
I mean, I'm a Gemini.
Really?
So, yeah. So my internal sense is like very wavy. Yeah.
That's great, because I'm a Gemini moon. So,
So I have so much to learn, because I'm like, as a Gemini, I need external, because I could be everywhere and I am everywhere. And I mean, people close to me tell me I am everywhere. Like, and I've never, you know, that's part of why I'm like, I'm not part of a single movement. Like, I can, partly because obviously analytically I understand it's all connected, and also because I rarely say no. Internally, you're right. I will come back to my previous answer. Everything that I mean, I won't say that I have no internal compass, but I will say that everything that I know is 100% in relation to other people. Like, I have learned it from and through other people, through people's experiences, through what people have shared. So it's hard for me to parse out my own internal compass, because all of it really is also bound up in being part of other people's lives, you know? So even, for example, things that I may have, like my commitments to Indigenous sovereignty are part of my commitments in large part because of what I have learned from Indigenous land defenders and being welcomed onto different nations' territories to be part of struggle. So they're bound up together in that my accountabilities and relationality and internal compass is completely informed by having been part of, in very tangible ways, so many different people's struggles. My commitment to fighting borders is, you know, partially informed by my own experiences and my family's experiences, but is more, you know, equally, if not more, informed by having been part of so many anti-deportation fights. And learning through each one, you know, and witnessing the pain of each one and recommitting each time, because you just keep seeing it and refusing to be desensitized to it, because each time there's, you know, a new reason to get angry and another reason to fight and another reason to stay committed to the fight. And so that for me is also partly how I tend to answer questions about burnout, because I do think for me, one of the main reasons that, I mean, I get asked a lot, like, how have you not burnt out in like 20 plus years? And for me, I'm like, my understanding of burnout from what everything I've observed is, you know, we tend to burn out for, you know, not because like, I mean, of course the work is hard, but it's the emotional drain of the work, right? It's not like because you're up till midnight fighting and in struggle. It's because of like the hurt, the drain, the pain that causes that sense of like jadedness or hurt or like need to walk away, all of which are real and legitimate. For me, I feel like the reasons that I haven't burnt out aren't unique to me. It's nothing like innate to me, but it's just that so much of, for me, the struggle has been relational, that it actually keeps me energized rather than burnt out, you know, because it's actually moments where I haven't been able to be in relation, like the pandemic, the extreme isolation of the pandemic, for example, or, you know, moments of parenting or moments of disability, like that isolation is when I feel more burnt out, when my compass feels like disoriented. And so most of what keeps me energized is like being able to feed off each other's like fuel and fire and love and care and commitment. So it really truly is in relation.
So do you ever have something come up where you feel like you have to prove something? Like, I'm really hearing how much community and the relational is everything, like how that is your groundedness, it's your compass, it's what fuels you, how accountability is so essential to the work that you do and how you understand it. And then at the same time, I'm wondering about like imposter syndrome and how when you are so much in these relationships and doing this work with others, there can be maybe sometimes like an instability that can crop up from that feeling of an imposter syndrome or from, you know, other people's opinions or expectations. And I'm wondering if that has come up for you, maybe maybe an unhelpful sense of needing to prove like your intentions or needing to prove your worth or needing to prove your work. How have you experienced that?
Yeah, I'd say the imposter syndrome piece is mostly the kind of like world I find myself in now with like writers and like in my previous job around lawyers, like more of the kind of professionalizing aspect of it. And this is a bit of a dichotomy, but I find myself in like fairly different worlds. The more kind of public facing ones are like, you know, policy or writers or academics, like, and because I have foots in each of those places, but I'm not really part of any of those worlds. Like I didn't write a book as an academic scholar. I didn't write it as a writer, which is a weird thing to say, but you know, like creative writers who have like beautiful creative processes and beautiful ideas. So like those worlds are where I feel the most like, what am I doing here? Imposter syndrome-y in, and also they're not that they're not relational, but you know, it feels like you're, or my, I should say, kind of access to those spaces is based on having produced some certain things, based on having had certain training, being trained in a certain language. So those always feel tentative and impostery. And yeah, but the ones that feel where I can be in service, where they are, you know, relational, where even if I'm not clear on my skills, like I, for example, have really crappy graphic design skills. And like have, you know, often completely been unhelpful and failed people with my Microsoft Word posters. But I feel less impostery because you're in the relationship with people in a different way, right? It's like a bunch of grannies will look at it and they're like, this is amazing. I'm like, really? This is so bad, but okay. I mean, there's some like really bad posters out there in the world. They're probably made by me and you'll notice them, including some that you'll see this year. So
that's great. Yeah. It's very relatable.
Yes.
So in those moments, like, you know, I know that I don't have the particular skills, but I don't feel as impostery because the relations are different. I don't feel like my entry into those worlds is contingent on, you know, production within capitalism in a particular way, if that makes sense. They are more relational and like sometimes I have skills that are useful and sometimes not at all, but I can make my way through that. Mm. It's the other worlds where it's completely dependent on, you know, elitist and capitalist ideas of who we are and how we produce and how we perform versus our whole selves.
And how do you cope with that? Like, does that make you not want to be in those worlds as much? Or is there a way that you stay in those worlds and just cope with that feeling?
I think I'm not in those worlds, you know, like intentionally so, and that is not my life. I'm not in the academy. I'm not a lawyer. I don't practice as a lawyer. I don't sit at government tables. I engage with them when it's strategically useful for me to engage in those worlds and as part of broader movements. So those are tactical decisions. And so they're few and far between and they have a rationale behind them. You know, the rationale might be like, you know, dropping in on a class because the students are interested in borders, but I'm not a teacher of borders. I don't deal with the academy. And obviously it's not the students, it's the broader institution, like having to, you know, prove yourself. None of which is a judgment on people who do engage in those systems. It's just that, yeah, that is how I cope. I do it strategically and it's not my day to day.
I'm so enjoying this conversation because I'm like thinking back to all the moments in the past where I've like, you know, read something that you've written or was in a class and I was taught about Harsha Walia and I was like, oh my God, she's incredible. And I'm really appreciating how you're situating both, you know, your sense of like your compass and your power always in relationship to other people. And also recognizing the places where you're like, yeah, that's not for me. Like, I'm not the like academic in this classic way. I'm not the artist or whatever it might be. And I wanted to ask, I know that it can be, at least for myself, maybe this is a projection, it can be really vulnerable to like acknowledge this is my shit and this is not my shit. This is my bag and this is not my bag. Mm-hmm. And So often, at least for me, I've spent so much time in fear of what if I'm not being what people need me to be? There's so much hurt and there's so much harm and there's so much like that people are wading through. And I find myself, yeah, just really preoccupied with like, what am I supposed to do? Who am I supposed to be? I'm curious if you were to let, you know, the audience know who it is that you are and who you want to be seen as, how would you describe that? Because you've shared so much with us and I'm so grateful. And I'm curious about that self-definition. What really resonated with me was like, when you choose, what is strategic, when it makes sense for you. And there's this like sense of self-knowing, obviously, that's connected to that, knowing what's right for you, knowing what you're good at, knowing, you know, all these other things. So yeah, I'm curious, how would you let others, or how would you describe yourself if you were going to sort of introduce yourself as you are?
I mean, I would say, especially in this moment, because so much of how I think, projection on a projection of how I think, you know, folks may know my work. It's through, for example, writing and books. And for me, I would emphasize that I'm primarily an organizer who has gleaned knowledge through movement. Like there really is no liberation in isolation. Any knowledge production that is attributed to me is truly from the context of movements, right? Like that for me is who I am. Like I didn't know any of this shit. Like I didn't know this, right? Like I studied it and learned it alongside others. And I think the other piece is like really for me that I'm a co-learner. I think one thing that can happen is this idea that we, you know certain things, and like, I know certain things, you know, certain things, we all know certain things. And we're all experts in certain parts of our lives and in certain parts of what we can offer the movement, but none of us are definitively experts on all the things. That's just not possible. And so for me, the concept and the reality of co-learning is so important for me to emphasize in these moments where someone like me can be read as an expert. And I know that I'm not. And I know that the things that I do have expertise in have come through time and struggle and comradeship. And that's big for me. And I think one of the things that is part of the organizing, and maybe this is why the piece around relations come out so much, is it truly is the part where I feel the most at home in my life and in movements is relationships, as messy as they are, but really committing to people and communities in the long term is something that means a lot to me. And you know, I know that that's not always visible in things like social media, because those are not the visible parts of our life or our work. But for me, I think those are what build movement muscle. They're what keep us in the struggle in different ways. I don't think the struggle is one uniform thing. It's an ecosystem, whatever that looks like. And you know, the idea, like there's a saying in Oaxaca, amongst an indigenous organization called SIPO. And I learned this from them decades ago, and it stays with me, which is that, you know, we are one heart and many hands in the struggle. And I think, of course, the idea of many hands, but the only way in which we even know how we are one heart is if we are actually connected, right? Like constantly in conversation, constantly showing up for people. And so I think those invisible forms of primarily gendered labor, of showing up for each other in collective care, that's a big part of what I do, what I can offer and what people offer me. But I think that's also invisible. And I think just such a big part of what informs my work. And that's influenced how I do this work. And maybe the last thing is like parenting has really shifted my paradigm on all things, because it just has forced me to think about time and commitment differently. You know, just to that earlier point of how you cut out noise. I'm like, what, you know, when you have a kid, your time and brain capacity collapses in a particular way. And also forward looking, right? I don't think one has to be parent, but I think in all the ways in which we're caregivers, whatever that looks like for different people, that allows us to think about time in the future in really grounded ways has also made a big difference in terms of just prioritizing commitments and, you know, cutting out noise and trying to really focus on what will build a better future for all of us and for the years.
Bars. I will say that's, thank you so much for just everything that you're offering us today. Like, I didn't know what to expect, and this conversation has been so lovely. And I was going to say, because Lala's like our resident astrologer, and she would disagree with that, but she is. And I was going to ask Lala, is she not a classic Gemini, like learning in all directions? I'm sensing it. I'm really feeling it. Do you agree?
I do. I mean, I really feel like the breadth, but I would be so curious to see the whole chart. I am feeling so enriched by your anchoring in community and relational and like collectivism. I feel like I'm going to be processing that and thinking about that for a long time, the way everything, no matter how individual it can seem, can be rooted back to the relational and how incredibly anchoring that can be, regardless of like all of the noise and the storms that, you know, happen around you, especially in some of these public facing roles that you've occupied. So yeah, I'm just so grateful to you for sharing with us. And I'm going to be thinking about this for a long time.
Thank you both for those deep questions. Like, I don't usually go that deep, and I'm sure that wasn't even deep. That was probably surface. For me, it was so deep. And so I'm thankful for the space and the container. And again, just the thoughtfulness. And, you know, it means a lot that people are trying to think about, you know, how we do this together in a way that's about our shared humanity versus our visibility.
Thank you, Harsha. Thank you so much. So that was, I would say, such a lovely conversation with Harsha. Like, I don't know what I expected it to be like, but it blew my mind. It made me realize a lot about my own personal reflections and like why, you know, this episode to me was an opportunity for me to ask a person who I really admire how they struggle with things that I struggle with. And it's like, from that conversation, I feel like I learned that she doesn't struggle with things that I struggle with, but it was actually kind of, I mean, she does, but it's not a struggle for her. She's just noticing and aware of herself. And so, yeah, I'm wanting to talk with you about this concept of being seen in perfectionism and anything that Harsha raised that felt like it changed your perspective of how you do what you do, because I think you have quite a visible, you know, role in community with healing and color and with your practice, right? Was there anything that Harsha mentioned that is still sort of like tingling for you, resonating for you, that is shifting sort of how you are, you know, understanding this idea of perfectionism or this fear of being seen?
Yeah, I think what was really amazing about talking to her was how it always came back to the relational. She was so deeply and firmly anchored in the relational. And I think no matter how many times we kind of, not that we're, I don't think of us as being, you know, incredibly individualist people, but I feel like we kept trying to be like, but you alone, though, how does that, you know? And it just, she always brought it back. And I mean, my initial reaction, my biggest reaction was just, oh, this is why her work is so good. But I think it was really, I don't know. I don't know if I want to say inspiring, but... No, but it was like I just felt like that felt like a beacon to me, you know, an invitation to really anytime I'm feeling some sort of self-consciousness or some sort of like, you know, ego-based reaction, to come back to the community, to come back to who I'm in relationship with and really focus there.
It was inspiring. It was like, I don't even know, like there's so many words to it, but yeah, you're right. We kept on trying to like ask her, but like, what about you? And she was like, what about us though? What about how we are doing? And
And one thing that really struck me, especially in the beginning when she was describing like how her organizing started off really small and it was like three people coming to a protest or coming to, you know, something that she and her friends had been like organizing, and the premise of this episode being like the fear of being seen. And she was like, no, we were trying to be heard. Like, we were really trying to get people to come out. And so the fact that we only had three people there was like, well, fuck, like, that's our plan. We need to have more bodies. Like, we need more people to be aware. And it made me think about like how she clearly believed that her message and the work that she was doing or and is doing was so important that it needed to be seen, that it wasn't something that she was like fearing, but she was stepping towards or moving towards or trying to like cultivate. And it also made me think of like, so much of the reason I wanted to have this conversation in the first place was like in my own work, how oftentimes I am like, oh my God, people are going to be really critical, or people are critical and people need things from me. And I asked her that question of like, people expect things from you. Talking to her made me ask myself, like, who's actually listening as well? Like, and not to like deflate or minimize the impact of the work that I'm doing, but it's actually more helpful to me to think about like, it's not like all eyes are on you, Nick, because that is part of ego. Like when you mentioned before about like there's some sort of like ego thing happening here, and it's sort of like stoking and fanning the flames of not even just imposter syndrome, but like all the things related to it. Like you got to be perfect, you got to say the right things and all that stuff. And it's like talking to Harsha was such a breath of fresh air, because it's like, well, maybe it's three people that are listening, and that's okay too. Do you believe enough in your message or in what you're doing that it makes it still worth it? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that was really comforting to hear, because it can, in the age of social media especially, I think it can be so easy to get sucked into the kind of numbers game and how many people looked at this, how many people liked it, how many people shared it, all that kind of thing, and measuring the worth of your work through those numbers.
Yes.
And I think it was really comforting to hear that from her. It felt like it's okay to let that go. And yeah, to have a more kind of substantial way of looking at what you're doing. And yeah, in terms of ego, like ego, I don't think ego is just arrogance, you know, when it's used in that way. Ego can also be like a self-consciousness, like an imposter syndrome, like I feel like I'm worse than other people, just as much as it can be I feel like I'm better than other people. And so I think that is such a huge part of that fear of being seen. There is like a real kind of focus on I. And I think something that was really beautiful about Harsha's perspective is how deeply rooted she is in we.
She said something at the end like valuing our shared humanity versus our visibility. And I was like, ooh, like that to me is such an invitation to really think about the value that I place on, what did my sister call this? You know, when you're playing a computer game and there's like a main character, you're the main character, and there's like your sibling that's playing against you. Then there's a bunch of like background characters and they're like non-identifiable players. And it's like so much of, I think, the fear that has been driving the ship in my like work life or the work that I do that's visible to others and for others and with others has been about like centering those non-identifiable players, people who I don't even know. And I really appreciated, to your point and to all of Harsha's points, like the importance in really centering the value of your work in a way that's always connected back to the people that you have relationships with. And then that made me think about, oftentimes we talk about like, what is community? And we had an episode on like, what does it mean to talk about community? Is it like people that you're best friends with? Is it like people that you work with? Is it people that you go to a protest with? But yeah, like so much more is possible when we are like able to value
the work we do with other people, not just for other people, but with other people. And I really appreciated her, yeah, always coming back to her compass, her power, her sense of self, her knowing like that the work is like meaningful or good is always through that lens of relationship.